Arwen, do you ever feel like you're being watched?
Absolutely, all the time.
And I mean like actual surveillance.
No, that's what I mean too. I think in a post 9/11 world, we know that we are all constantly being surveilled, wiretaps, things like that. It's just out there.
Yeah, it's out there. And it feels like something that is really out of our control. But there's actually a piece of this that you can get to the bottom of pretty easily on your own. So I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm here with senior producer Arwen Nix.
Hello.
And we are here to talk a little bit about this question of surveillance and getting to the bottom of it without hiring a team of fancy lawyers, without going to law school, without doing a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington thing. Basically, this is something you can do yourself. And that's the reason that we are bringing it up. Our theme today is DIY. And our first DIY lesson here on Sound Effect is how to request your own FBI file. So this is all made possible by this particular law, right?
Yes, the Freedom of Information Act, which basically gives us the right to ask any government agency for information they have on us. And unless it's like an active and open case, they have to tell us the truth. If they're watching us and they have a file, they have to send it to us.
So how do I do that? Can I just write them a postcard and say, send me my file?
Well, it's actually not much more complicated than that. You go to a website called getmyfbifile.com. It's one of many websites that can help you with this process. You type in some information, name, date of birth, place of birth, and it generates all these form letters. And you can click all these boxes for which three-letter agency that you want to request information from.
Then you send them off in the actual mail. And we did this not too long ago, you and me.
Just about a month ago.
Yeah. And lo and behold, about 3 weeks later, I got a letter from the FBI. And so part of the deal of us doing this was that we both committed to revealing the contents of our letters on the air, no matter what they might contain, embarrassing or not. So I am about to do that now. I have this letter right in my hand. I'm just going to read it to you. You ready?
Ready.
Okay. Dear Mr. Spitzer, this is in response to your Freedom of Information and Privacy Act's request. Based on the information you provided, we conducted a search of the central records. We were unable to identify main file records responsive to the FOIPA. So nothing.
So did you only get a response back from the FBI?
That's it, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah. No, I'm like response rich right here. So should I open up some of these other letters?
Yes, you're going to do that. And you really are going to read whatever's in them. You promise?
Yeah, I promise. Okay. And if you never see me again, maybe this is why.
All right.
Okay. From the CIA, I have, Dear Mr. Nix, man, the government is misgendering me. Although our searches were reasonably calculated to uncover all relevant documents, it is highly unlikely that repeating those searches would change the result. You nevertheless have the legal right to appeal. So I think what they're saying is we can't find anything, but we're not going to make you a promise that we don't have anything.
Classic.
Yeah. Real CIA.
Both incomprehensible and inconclusive.
All right. Department of Defense. No documents responsive to your request were found. This one's got a legit signature on it, though. Nothing. Nothing from DSS. Nothing. The U.S. Department of Justice, United States Marshals Service, same.
So how do you feel knowing that apparently law enforcement and intelligence gathering agencies have taken almost no notice of you whatsoever?
Do you want me to tell you how I honestly feel?
Yes.
I didn't think I was being watched until they told me I wasn't.
Nevertheless, it is one of those things that you can do without getting the help of an expert. It is a DIY affair, and we are going to bring you tales of people doing it themselves from all over our region. That's just ahead on Sound Effect from KPLU. Don't go away. So thinking about DIY, you know, there's this whole maker culture, people teaching themselves computer programming or electrical engineering or carpentry. Well, how about a little DIY genetic engineering or biochemistry or neuroscience? So this is part of a real life movement around DIY biology. And the place to find out about this is a group up in Seattle's U District called Hive Bio. Bergen McMurray is its founder and its CEO.
So this part is the lab proper, where all of the magic happens. We have some PCR machines. We have a couple of freezers.
What's PCR?
Hey, guys.
Polymerase chain reaction.
P
PCR is a technique that is used to amplify strands of DNA.
So this lab space, how would you describe what it looks like for somebody who can't see?
It's a little small. A whole bunch of equipment kind of shoved into every possible nook and cranny. Everything that we have is donated as far as equipment and disposables. And even the lab benches, I built some of them. We have a kitchen and a conference room and a microbiology room.
People can work on their own projects here, you know, things they can't do at work or in their garage. Maybe they want to mess with the genes of a marigold or culture yogurt bacteria or something. And some of the projects are these big group collaborations.
The members are looking at the DNA of particular pieces of salmon that they bring in to find the location of where those salmon were spawned.
I mean, is it an academic exercise or is there some thing that you're driving toward?
Well, usually in DIY bio, there's a thing that you're driving towards, right? So with Citizen Salmon, I believe that the goal is to create a process where you can check to see if your salmon is farmed or fresh that could be replicated so people can do that process eventually in their own homes or in other DIY bio spaces like this.
If you're starting to get worried right about now about mad scientist stuff or people accidentally releasing a killer virus or something, they say don't worry about it. They have a board that oversees all the projects and makes sure that they're safe and ethical. But it is true that there's no outside inspections. There's no big institutional oversight of any kind. This is DIY, and they don't call it biohacking for nothing. Bergen McMurray explained to me that the story of Hive Bio started more than a decade ago. So how did Hive Bio get underway? How did they get started?
Well, I was actually working in the field of photography, and my son got diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And the psychiatrist at the time, even though he was 5 years old, recommended that we put him on lithium. And I didn't know anything about science or biology or brains at the time, but the idea of putting a 5-year old on an antipsychotic seemed like not a good idea to me. So I started doing some independent research on neuroscience, and I mean, I had to start from scratch. So I was learning about the brain, learning about neurochemistry, learning about bipolar disorder. And after a couple of months of intensive self-driven research, I came up with an idea, a set of supplements and like diet changes that I could put him on that may deal with his bipolar disorder. And lo and behold, it worked really, 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 really well. That is kind of what pushed me into neuroscience, exploring the brain in a self-driven way.
Have you consulted with physicians or anybody like that about it? I mean,
sure.
Is it fringy stuff or not?
No, not fringy at all. It's a set of supplements. I wouldn't have tried anything dangerous with my son's brain. And everything I tried on my son, I tried on myself first.
How did you get the idea that I just put my mind to this, I could do this?
Well, I'm hypomanic, so it's kind of in my genes to think that I can do anything. When people have a need and they can't get that need met for whatever reason, it's usually like a lack of resources, right? I was a single mom. Single moms aren't rolling in the dough. As a group of people, single moms were generally broke. So I didn't, at that time, have the money to go to school for 4 years and get a traditional education about neuroscience in that way. But my son needed help. So I did what needed to be done.
So you decided that neuroscience was you were interested in neuroscience beyond just that one goal-oriented thing. You were interested in the whole discipline.
Right around that time is when I started working at the Allen Institute for Brain Science. And I wanted to try out some of my ideas and some of the methods that I'd been reading about in an actual lab space. And the Allen Institute has a bunch of lab space, but you can't just go in the lab and start working on projects. Generally, you can rent independent lab space, but there's a really high price point. It's like, I think, a minimum of $2,000 a month for a bench at one of those places.
$2,000 a month?
Somewhere in there. Yeah.
How much do people pay to work here?
Under $100.
How did you get from wishing that there was a place like this to making a place like this?
Like, being part of the maker community, I was generally familiar with the concept of DIY bio.
This is a thing. You didn't invent it.
Yeah, I didn't invent it. I will definitely not take credit for that. DIY bio has been around roughly since like 2005, 2007, something like that. And it came from other makerspaces wherein there were people hacking and stuff like that. And a subset of that group of people were like, well, if we can do this with programming, why can't we do it with genes? So I secured a space within one of my friends' hackerspaces.
I'm just going to ask you again, because I think that it's a mentality that is very natural to you and a little bit foreign, I think, to a lot of other people, the idea that you could just do this. And, I mean, you said you didn't have any money. You're a single parent. You're a very busy person, a working mother. Wouldn't it be so easy just to be like, wow, if I were a gazillionaire and had 10 nannies, I could, you know, do something cool like this. You didn't wait around for that.
No, I didn't wait around for that. And, like, I didn't grow up with a lot of money. My family was on food stamps and stuff. So you get used to and comfortable with and enjoy building things that you need. I was also a punk rocker when I was in high school. So the punk rock community is a very much make your own stuff community.
Is it fair to call this punk biology?
Oh, absolutely.
So what's it been like to watch people coming in here and pursuing their own interests or collaborating on one of these big projects that you guys have ongoing? How do you feel about watching that?
I find it incredibly rewarding. You just watch people's eyes light up when they get to see and touch a sheep brain for the first time, or that when they learn through a hands-on experiment like how PCR works or how to run a gel. This is the kind of opportunity that unless you're in school, most people just don't have access to, even if they want to.
So it seems like a lot of this is very practically driven. Is there some ideology in there too? I mean, is it a statement or a reaction to the corporate or academic control of the sciences?
When I was in high school, science and math, especially as a woman or as a girl at the time, were perceived as like really hard. Like you had to be an exceptionally smart person to even understand anything. This is really not the case. So part of our mission is to help them realize, dude, it's not that hard. Like, we can all do this and we can do it together. And you don't have to be a genius to explore science and come up with hypotheses of your own.
So at this point, we had to cut out to go peek back in the lab because people were arriving for one of HiBio's low-cost classes. And this one is on bioinformatics, which is basically how to organize and interpret complex biological data. And one of the things you can do with that is reconstruct the genetic information of ancient organisms. So people of all ages are crowding at these lab tables, and a guy named Blake Allen introduces the lesson in how to build a dinosaur. Okay, maybe not literally, but this is as close as we're going to get to a DIY dino.
So Jurassic Park was a lie. Why was Jurassic Park a lie? Well, dinosaurs lived 68 million years ago, and under ideal conditions, DNA degrades in about 6.8 million years or so. You can see all the DNA in these amber enclosed mosquitoes would have already degraded. But that's okay, because we can still design a dinosaur.
Could you tell me your name, please?
Alex Meredith.
And how old are you?
16.
So what brings you in here today?
My mom actually saw something about this online, and so she signed our whole family up, so we're all here.
So you're being forced to be here?
I thought it sounded interesting. She actually asked me first, yeah.
What sounded interesting about it to you?
Well, I'm taking computer science at school, and so I'm interested in informatics and stuff, and I've also done some biology, and my mom's actually a biology professor, so it sounded pretty cool.
So you're the mom. Why did you? What made you think that this would be fun for your whole family?
We're a nerdy group of people, and I thought it sounded like a lot of fun.
Where do you teach?
I teach at Seattle Pacific University.
So as a sort of legit biology professor, what do you make of the whole DIY bio movement?
I'm all for it. Research costs a lot of money, so anything that increases access to research facilities is great in my opinion.
Do you worry at all about lay people coming in and doing stuff like this?
I'm hoping that they don't try to do anything that's beyond their capabilities, but presumably there are regulations that will prevent people from accessing things that could be potentially very dangerous. But I think a lot of this stuff, I mean, informatics is not something that is going to be, I mean, I don't think anyone's going to leave from here and build our own dinosaur afterwards, so I think it'll be okay.
You happy about the turnout?
Very happy about the turnout. There's a lot of people and a pretty good split between adults and kids, which I always like to see in our classes.
What do you hope those folks walk out of here with?
I hope that they walk out excited about science in a way that they weren't before.
I'm sure you're really busy making this organization run, but do you have any personal projects that you would like to do one of these days in this place?
Oh, absolutely. My interest in neuroscience is really focused on the intersection between neuroscience and nutrition. So I have a long list of concepts for research studies that I'd like to do, all of which are actually mostly doable in this lab. But so far, the tasks of a CEO keep me pretty busy.
Are any of them connected to the mental health stuff that your son and you deal with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, all of the aspects of neuroscience that I want to explore in some way relate back to mental health, for sure. Because generally speaking, a person's personality is the cumulative result of a bunch of chemical and electrochemical processes in the brain, right? So if we can support those in the right way through nutrition and, if needed, pharmaceuticals, we can give people happier lives. And I would really love to have my research be a part of figuring out how to make that work well for people.
Well, Bergen McMurray is the CEO and founder of Hive Bio, the community-based DIY bio lab up here in the U District in Seattle. Thanks so much for being on our show.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. This is our DIY show. And for this next segment, we are welcoming back Jenna Morlone. She's joined us a few times before, and she heads up the Center for Philosophy for Children at the University of Washington. And as part of her gig, she often goes into classrooms of kids of all ages and takes a book with her and uses that as a jumping off point to open up a conversation about all kinds of philosophical questions and ideas. And so for today, I thought we would start out with a dramatic reading. You ready for this?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Here we go. What are you doing, Piggy?
I'm a frog.
You are a frog?
Yes.
I did not know that. I was sure you were a pig. You look like a pig, and your name is Piggy.
I was a pig. Now I am a frog. Ribbit.
All right. What is that?
Well, so this story is really an enchanting story about this friend. Well, there are lots of books about Piggy and Gerald, who is an elephant. And in this story, Piggy is, as you heard, decided she's going to pretend to be a frog. And Gerald is kind of mystified by this. Like, A, what do you mean you're a frog? You're a frog. And I know you're not a frog. And B, why would you pretend you are a frog? And what does that even mean? So that's what the story really is about.
And we should say Piggy and Elephant have a kind of a, I want to say a Dharma and Greg kind of a dynamic going on.
Right.
Where Piggy's a dreamer and Gerald is rather literal and needs to be loosened up once in a while.
Exactly.
What made you want to introduce this book to the students?
Well, first of all, kids love to pretend, right? I mean, I think we all love to pretend, but kids especially are always trying out identities, right? Being superheroes, being other people, playing out roles, classroom teacher, doctor, etc. So it's a really interesting question for children to consider. Why do we pretend? What does it mean to pretend? And as I usually do, I read the story to the children and then ask them, so what questions does this make you wonder about? And often the questions will be things like, why is Piggy pretending to be a frog? Or why is Gerald so upset that Piggy's pretending to be a frog? And why does Gerald think that's not something he can do?
And what moves this into the realm of a philosophical question for you, besides just a question about how maybe kids behave with each other?
Right. So the philosophical questions really are, how does pretending, how does trying out identities relate to constructing our own identities? Are our identities fluid, right? Do they depend on something inside of us? Do they depend on the experiences we have? How do they change over time? What makes us the same person, et cetera? So there are all kinds of philosophical questions that come out of this.
And how do kids come down on this idea of like how much control can you have over your own identity? How much can you make up your identity depending on what you feel or what you want?
Well, like adults, I would say kids are kind of all over the map on the question, but they're very interested often in talking about pretending and the way in which pretending can be helpful or can be problematic. So the conversations tend to be about the whole process of constructing your identity and the way in which we can aid that process or maybe harm it.
When we're thinking about this question of how, to what extent can we create our own identities? To what extent can we make a DIY project out of our own selves? It raises a lot of questions about things like race and gender and how much your identity comes from who you feel you are, who you believe you are, versus all the exterior cues and what other people think of you are. Did the kids seem like they made that connection at all?
Yeah, actually, I had a really interesting discussion with a group of fourth grade students where we had tried on different clothes and we were talking about the way what you wear affects your identity. And some of the children raised the issue that, in fact, the range of possible choices for boys were way narrower than for girls, because girls could wear dresses, they could wear skirts, they could wear all kinds of colors, they could wear jeans, they could wear shorts. And so we had this very interesting discussion about whether that meant that the range of possible identities for boys were in fact narrower in some ways than for girls, even though in other social ways, the range of identities for girls were way narrower. We talked about the fact that girls are always expected, for example, to be nice and pleasant in a way that boys have a lot more leeway. So it was pretty interesting.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. So did you have a takeaway that you wanted them to get from this book, or is it more about asking the questions?
I wanted them to think about this practice that most of them engage in all the time, probably without a whole lot of analysis, right? They don't really think about, why am I doing this, or what's the purpose of this? And for me, philosophical inquiry is all about taking the most ordinary events of our lives and reflecting about them and thinking about why we do them, about the practice in general, about its relationship to other parts of our lives. And because pretending is such a big part of kids' lives, this kind of book, I think, can really make philosophy come alive for them. And some of the kids really sympathize with Gerald. Some of the kids who are also sort of more concrete and very practical, they get why he's sort of like, 5 minutes ago you were a pig, how can you possibly be a frog now? Whereas other children don't sympathize with him at all.
And how does the book end?
The book ends with Gerald deciding that he can pretend, in fact. He has this exchange with Piggy where Piggy says, you can pretend. He says, no, I can't. She says, sure you can. He says, no, I can't. Sure you can. And then she says, why can't you pretend to be a frog? And he says, moo, because I'm a cow. And that's how the book ends.
Well, Jana Morlone is not a frog, but she does head the UW Center for Philosophy for Children. Thank you for joining us again on our DIY show, Jana.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. So have you ever found yourself frustrated by a problem or a situation that no one is doing anything about? And then all of a sudden you find that you are the one who fixes it. And from there, you become like the go-to person every time it comes up again. Well, this week on Sound Effect, we're talking about what it means to do it yourself. KPLU's Jennifer Wing introduces us to a woman named Bonnie Hammond. And here is what she's doing something about: rescuing abused horses. Hammond leads a nonprofit in Woodinville, and it's the place that animal control officers call when they first get new cases. These horses are often on the brink of death and have nowhere else to go.
Anyone who is remotely interested in buying a horse should talk to Bonnie Hammond.
Caring for horses is very expensive.
Hammond is the executive director of SAFE, otherwise known as Save a Forgotten Equine. She says if you buy a horse, be prepared to spend serious money on food.
The cost of hay has risen obscenely.
Horse teeth need to be filed down. If not, they get jagged and cut the inside of their cheeks. Hooves have to be trimmed.
Even without putting horseshoes on them, it typically costs about $40 a trim.
They have complicated digestive systems.
There's a lot that can go wrong in there.
If you don't have space for them at your place, you have to pay rent for them to live somewhere else. In the Seattle area, boarding rates go from $600 a month
up to $1,000, $1,200 a month.
Many of the horses at Safe are there because their former owner did not think these things through. Hammond did not plan to be the person who takes in the starving, fearful creatures that are the result of people's poor planning and mistakes. In fact, Hammond didn't have her first riding lesson until she was in her 30s when she had a job as a graphic designer. As a child, she was
a horse nutty girl.
She read the entire Black Stallion series.
The Marguerite Henry, Misty of Chincoteague, and all that. I read those to tatters.
She watched horse racing on TV. Movies about horses.
Be kind. Be patient with them. After a while, he'd be following you around like a happy hound dog.
A lot of these books and films repeat the same message over and over.
I read this article about what you do for people with horse problems.
Well, truth is, I help horses with people problems.
By the time Hammond was 39 years old, she finally realized her childhood dream of learning how to ride and owning her own horse.
Then my horse needed a friend, and that's the point when I stumbled upon the efforts that people were making in this area to help horses headed to slaughter. And once I found that world, everything really started to snowball.
She worked with others to save two horses stuck in a feedlot. Once word of this successful rescue spread, Hammond's phone started to ring with news of other horses in desperate need.
It was early 2008, and we were asked to help with a neglect case that was going on in both King County and Snohomish County. And all of a sudden, we were being asked to take in about 17 horses. It was part of a horrible case of neglect and abuse that was done by someone who considered themselves a professional horse breeder. And there were also, I think, as many as 9 horses who had died on the properties as well.
She helped organize a candlelight vigil at a park in Monroe for the horses that died. It was after that that Hammond realized rescuing horses is something she would be doing for the rest of her life.
And I didn't do it through any other means than just having the energy and the inclination. I had no special training. There was nothing that led me to this point except having the desire to do it.
Safe went from being an idea to a farm in Woodinville with pastures and stables. The organization cares for 28 horses. It costs more than $12,000 a month to operate. Hammond does most of the fundraising. A small army of volunteers works around the clock doing everything from cleaning out stalls to training the horses to be calm with a rider. Hammond says an untrained horse is destined for a troubled life.
People don't want a horse that's going to run away when you try to catch them, and they don't want a horse that's going to, try to buck you off every time you sit down on them, or a horse that is badly behaved. The horses that keep homes are the ones that are pleasant to be around, and you can enjoy the good part of horse ownership.
Over the years, Safe has placed 168 rescued horses in new homes, but things don't always work out so well. In the spring of 2015, animal control officers in Snohomish County seized 3 horses, 2 mares and a gelding, a male horse. They were all starving. The gelding was wearing a blanket that was falling apart, trapping in water close to his skin. Hammond wasn't prepared for what she saw when the blanket was finally removed. Not only could you see this horse's rib cage, he also had a severe case of a bacterial infection called rain rot.
It was the worst rain rot I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen anything like it, and I hope I never see anything like it again. His entire back was just a thick scab. It covered every inch of his back, and it was probably about an inch thick of scabby, crusty material.
Rain rot hurts, but it's a condition that's easy to treat if it's caught early. Hammond says if the owner had just taken the blanket off the horse and regularly brushed him, the rain rot would have never gotten to such a horrific state. He was too far gone, and they had to put him down.
After he had passed away, the veterinarian literally lifted a huge section of skin and hair and scabs off of his back that came off in one piece, and underneath the skin was necrotic and pussy, and it smelled awful, and it was just horrifying.
He was rotting.
He was literally rotting alive.
After the other horses were on their way to gaining weight and getting back to a healthy condition, the owner's lawyer discovered a technicality, a mistake with how the search warrant was issued. None of the evidence, the pictures showing the neglect, would be allowed in court. The trial's been put on hold indefinitely. The owner accused of the abuse got to take her remaining horses home. Hammond fears for their future.
And it hurts that they're just gone, you know.
Hammond says despite this case, the experience of the last several years has shown her that if you see things in this world you don't like, you, yes, you, can actually do something about it.
If you just open yourself up to trying and don't hold yourself back by saying, well, I've never done this before. Because everything you do, you've never done before at one point. So I encourage, you know, everybody to, if there's something that you want changed in the world, go ahead and try to change it. It's really possible.
Hammond hopes the case involving the two starving horses that were returned to their owner will be resolved before it's too late. Meanwhile, Safe is preparing to take in three new emaciated horses that were confined to filthy stalls on a property in Monroe.
KPLU's Jennifer Wing. It's Sound Effect from KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. Our last story of DIY comes from KPLU's own Nick Morrison. He told us about this moment he had recently that brought back some memories from his pre-KPLU life.
I was reading a really good book on the history of Northwest rock and roll called Sonic Boom. The author started talking about the magazine The Rocket, a music publication. Do you want me to read you the quote?
Sure, now, sure.
It says, "Then too, a new local music publication, The Rocket, sprang into being with a fundraising benefit gig held in September 1979 at the Showbox Theater." And I read that and my heart sort of dropped.
Why?
Because I didn't get credit for being the guy who financed the first issue of The Rocket.
So, okay, tell us about how that happened. Unspool it for us.
All right, well, right about the time I got into radio, I started writing about music and sending these little articles to the Seattle Sun, and they began publishing them. The publisher of the magazine liked my writing a lot. So one day he called me and a photographer into a meeting, and he said, "What would you think about doing a monthly insert, et cetera, et cetera?" And we both said, "You bet." Well, then this publisher left his job and went to publish the Willamette Week. A man named Bob McChesney came into the publisher's role at the Seattle Sun. So McChesney called me and two of his employees, Robert Ferrigno, writer and editor, and Bob Newman, a graphics guy. And we started basically formatting this idea.
So lots of people have ideas, right? But not everyone has the wherewithal to actually execute them, make them happen. That takes some resources. So how did you guys sort of get that missing piece?
Well, it began with a salesperson from the Seattle Sun, a man who you may know, named Danny O'Brien. His job was to try to go out and sell a full back page ad. We figured out that it would cost us $1,000 to get the first issue going. So O'Brien was going around asking people to spend $1,000 on a full page ad in a publication that didn't exist.
How did you, in your own DIY ethos, figure that out?
Well, we kept having these weekly meetings where Danny O'Brien would come in and say, "Oh, I was so close. I was so close. I almost had it sold." And it finally got to be kind of boring. And I had a vacation savings account. And I thought that this would be my opportunity to make a wonderfully grand gesture. So I went to the bank and I took out $1,000 in $100 bills, put it in my shirt pocket. And so we're all sitting around at this restaurant across the street from the Seattle Sun headquarters. It's the same conversation. We're ready. So I said, are we? I mean, if there was $1,000 sitting on the table right here, right now, could we just go? Could we do it if it was sitting right here? Yes. So I produced it and threw the 10 $100 bills on the table and said, let's rock. I probably didn't say let's rock, but I wish I would have.
Of course.
So what was the reaction you got? Do you remember?
Hooray.
Were you a hero? Did they put you on their shoulders?
Oh, very momentarily. Because out of the four-person combine there, I was the guy who knew the least about publishing. I was constantly behind. I was constantly catching up. And it got to the point where I really felt like I was holding these guys back, if not making them mad at me. So I said, hey, I'll tell you what. Take me off the masthead, give me my money back, and I'll just contribute articles. And so I stepped down. After a couple of months after leaving, I got a check from the Rocket for $1,050. So I made $50 on the Rocket.
I went ahead and contacted somebody else who would be knowledgeable about some of the matters that you're talking about here. And that person is, in fact, Danny O'Brien, former ad sales manager for the Seattle Sun. And here is what he had to say about the origin of the Rocket.
Oh, God.
Well, I remember it the way Nick remembers it.
He does?
Yeah.
Yeah, good for him. Still got my back.
He does. He verified that you, in fact, produced that $1,000 pretty much just as you said. He did add one other chapter, and that's that he says at the last minute he did execute an ad sale, and that between that ad buy and the seed money, that is what ensured that the Rocket would be up and running at least for some months.
Well, I'll gladly share credit with Mr. O'Brien, and I'm sure his memory is more accurate than mine.
Well, I should say we did reach out to the author, Peter Bleche, to ask him about this, and he did not contradict your version of events. He basically just said it happened during a very exciting time and that unfortunately he was not there to witness it firsthand, but he also didn't recant his account either. Tell me, why is the Rocket a big enough deal to find its way into a book chronicling rock and roll in the Northwest?
Because it was the first rock music paper to serve the area, and it served it at a very critical time. There was punk, there was metal, and those two genres were beginning to merge into what regrettably became called grunge. So this paper, in no small way, legitimized that and put it in front of people. And it could be argued, I guess, that that really pivotal music scene in Seattle may not have existed the way it did exist had it not been for the help of this rag. All of us wanted very badly to make this thing happen, to give this music a place to get reflected into the community. We wanted to write good stories about great music and try to get people to go out and experience it.
Well, Nick Morrison is a production manager here at KPLU, friend of Sound Effect, DIY maven, and founder-ish of The Rocket. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Sound Effect comes to you from the DIY Masters here at KPLU, senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had contributions from KPLU's Jennifer Wing and our interns Warren Langford and Casey Hicks. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We will be back next week with Tales of Silver Linings.
They didn't know that it's nearly 100% likely everyone with this disease is going to go deaf. They didn't know that.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.